when you look at the Tucker Carlson's interview with Vladimir Putin, he had the opportunity to talk to the Western audience. We know that the platform that Tucker Carlson has is huge, and it's going to have a huge impact. How did you find this interview?
Only the first thing is, last time I checked, it was up to almost 120 million views. That makes it the most watched interview in the history of interviews, which is tremendous. And I think it'll only go up from there. I think we'll have, you know, 500 million or more. Who knows how many people have watched this? And I think that's one of the reasons you saw such a panic in the mainstream media worldwide before this interview took place, because they rely on keeping hold of the narrative and not letting anyone else break through. And I think now the substance of the interview was fascinating. I enjoyed it. I watched all 2 hours of it. I'm sure for a lot of your viewers, myself and you as well, there was not a lot of new ground broken there. However, the significance of doing an interview, a straight interview with a person who's been so demonized, and to go on for 2 hours where hundreds of millions of people will see it, it's absolutely devastating to the narrative. And I think that's the real consequence of the Tucker Carlson interview.
Considering the solution to the conflict in Ukraine, he was talking about negotiations. He said that he's open to do whatever it takes to solve the situation in Ukraine. The question is this: is the Biden administration capable or willing to do such negotiations with Putin, or are they gonna leave it to the next administration?
I don't think they're capable of doing it. I mean, I think we saw very clearly in an unbelievable act of desperation, I suppose, but certainly an ill-thought-out act. They decided to have a spontaneous press conference with President Biden, I think at the time or right after the Tucker Carlson interview, where whether you like Putin or dislike him, you know, having a half an hour lecture on 1,000 years of Russian history with no notes is pretty spectacular. And then they trot out President Biden, who sadly enough, the guy is not with it. And he just proved in this press conference where he called Al-Sisi, the president of Mexico, he made a couple of other screw-ups. He's talked about talking to dead people over the past week, which has a lot of people scratching their heads. It's no surprise that put he and Putin together and compare the two of them in terms of ability to run a nation. So I don't think Biden is charged. Now, I don't think anybody thinks Biden is in charge. So who is in charge? It's the most recalcitrant people, the people that have been in charge of the State Department on and off for at least the past 12 or 13 years. You know, people like Victoria Nuland and Jake Sullivan, they were involved in the original coup in 2014 in Ukraine that brought the entire problem to a head. Forget the antecedents, the Orange Revolution in the early 2000s, but it really came to the head in the 2014. These people were in the center of it. They were literally planning it, you know, and now they're in positions of power. This is their baby, Blinken as well. There's absolutely no way they are capable, particularly as neocons, because they don't have a reverse gear, as some of the more astute observers notice. They can't back down. So I would say the only chance for a negotiated end to this conflict in terms of the U.S. involvement is a new administration.
In this interview, he was talking about Europe and how Europe perceives the situation in Ukraine. We've heard that recently Europeans were talking about fighting Russia.
Well, it's very interesting because if you remember, I think it was back in December, the Wall Street Journal came out with an article that says Germany has 2 days of ammunition if it happens to go to war with Russia. So I don't think you do a lot of tough talking if you have 2 days of ammunition. And also the Telegraph, the British Telegraph, I think it was just a few days ago, they reported that the new class of destroyer ships, they have gymnasiums where the rockets are supposed to go because they didn't have enough money for rockets. So they put in treadmills and gyms. So, I mean, if I were Europe, I wouldn't be talking tough about a war with Russia, with a Russia that's been at war now since 2014, with an intensified, you know, 2.5 years of hot war in Ukraine. It sounds like the playground weakling is trying to talk tough against the big tough guy. It's not a smart move.
We've heard that Putin was willing to reopen this pipeline that is still working between Russia and Germany, but you don't see anything coming from Germany. It seems that they're trying to destroy themselves. Even Putin was thinking, who are these guys and what they're thinking of? In your opinion, how we can understand this type of behavior?
I think that was one of the more interesting aspects of the interview with Tucker, is that Putin genuinely seemed perplexed. I don't understand why they're shooting themselves in the foot. And if, I mean, if there had been some success with the sanctions, with cutting off Russian gas, et cetera, then it might be understandable, but it's had the opposite. And I think as Putin pointed out in the interview, Russia has overtaken Germany as the number one economy in Europe. You know, I don't think, you know, there's ever been such an implosion in Germany. And I think you're starting to see it in the polls with the AfD now coming out of nowhere to a really almost a pole position in the polls now, and hence the call to actually ban the party. You know, we don't like the, we don't like what you're doing, so we're going to ban the party. It's something that used to go on, you know, in banana republics, but I guess we're doing it as well. We're banning a presidential contender from being on ballots, or trying to at least. But I don't think it's ever, I mean, I wonder if history will ever record such a self-immolation as we've seen in Europe. You know, talk about a suicide following the U.S. neocon foreign policy.
You talk about AfD, Alternative for Germany, this party. The leader of this party recently was talking about Dexit, which comes from Brexit. And they're thinking of getting out of European Union. Do you think the way that Germany is going right now, it's going to end up to this kind of solution coming from this party?
Well, there's so much anger in Germany, and you're seeing it now manifested in, among other things, the farmer protests. Germany and France and elsewhere, of course, which are shutting the country down. People have had enough. We haven't seen anything like this for quite some time. So you have the rise of parties like the AfD, and now I'm forgetting the name of the new left party, Sarah, you know, was named out. She was in Die Linke and she broke away. And now she's very popular on the left, and both of these parties have areas of agreement where you can imagine. I'm not an expert in German politics by any stretch of the imagination, but you can imagine a very different kind of, they'd probably call it red-brown coalition. I wouldn't say that, but you can imagine a devastation of the landscape in Germany. I mean, you've seen the Liberal Party has been decimated. It ceases to exist. And now even the CDU/CSU has a conservative breakaway party that's forming. Germany's falling to pieces.
In this interview, Putin talked about these ethnicities that are living in the western part of Ukraine, Romanians, Hungarians who are living there. It seems to me that the way that the Biden administration is handling the situation right now in Ukraine, it's going to end up Russia getting Odessa, Nikolaev, all these cities, and Ukraine getting to the point that we can call it a landlocked. If Ukraine gets to that point, in your opinion, what would be the future of Ukraine?
I mean, I think the other thing that he pointed out very interestingly, and it's something that I think a lot of the viewers hadn't heard of, when he talked about the deal in 2014 with Yanukovych, where the with the EU, and how that would have been a difficult situation for Russia. And so the decision of Ukraine to go with the EU deal, he talked about the fact, and it is a fact, and it goes to your question, that the eastern part of Ukraine had been the most industrialized. That's where the vast part of the GDP was produced. And there was a symbiosis with Russian industry up until that point, where, you know, Putin pointed it out very well, certain factories in one part would produce, one part of a good, and then they would go to the other side of the border. And this was a symbiosis left over from the Soviet Union, of course. And just cutting the ties of that destroys the economy of even the whole Ukraine. But as you're saying now, if you end up with a rump Ukraine, devoid of a lot of the agriculturally rich areas and devoid of the entirety of the industrial rich areas, you have, as my old friend John Lachlan once said, druggy skinheads in Lvov. That's basically all you have left in rump Ukraine. And you have, as you point out, the ethnicity problem, which is surprising even to me, because I lived in Hungary for quite some time, so I know a lot about what happened in Hungary in 1920 and Trianon and the carving up of the country after World War I. These ethnicity and minority problems have not really come to the fore, certainly since the end of the Cold War, I think. Now, all of a sudden, it's become a real issue. And Romania, as you mentioned, has chimed in. Hungary has been careful about it, but they have noted the disproportionate drafting of ethnic Hungarians from the West in the early part of the war. And there's been some problems with that. So all of a sudden, these things are shaking loose that hadn't been shaken up in decades, which is interesting and also frightening.
There is a moment in this interview in which Tucker Carlson is asking Putin, who's going to be on your side? Who's going to be on the other side? We have BRICS against G7. He says that why they have to be against each other? Just two parts of your brain. They have to work with each other to find some sort of solution for your body. When you look at this vision coming from a leader who was fighting, and you know, after the World War II, we didn't have any serious war up until the Ukraine war. In Ukraine, the collective West is fighting Russia. Here comes, after 19 months of this war of attrition in Ukraine, he comes with such a very fascinating idea that we have to work with each other. We don't have to be the enemy of each other.
I think it was a real window into his thinking and his mindset, you know, which is, and I think it explains the real hesitation. And I admit I was wrong. I did not think Russia would invade in February of 22, just because of the extreme conservatism of Putin up to that point. I mean, if you just go back to the March 2007 Munich summit, where he gave that dire warning, and then a year later, when the NATO summit opened the door to Georgia and Ukraine, as was pointed out in the interview as well, and provocation after provocation. I mean, you go back to 93 and the first wave of expansion of NATO, certainly, but even just the provocations up until the last, you know, 10 years or so, or 15 years, it shows the extreme patience that he's had. And I think to his political detriment at home, because I think a lot of people in the West don't understand that the opposition to Putin in Russia is not Navalny and all the liberals. It is the ultra conservatives, the people who say, why aren't we at war now? Why aren't we attacking the West right now? I mean, the militants are the ones opposing him because they're frustrated with his patience. He went through Minsk 1, Minsk 2, and we watched it, you know, everyone watched it be decimated and stepped on and stomped on, and nothing happened. And all of those years this was happening, he was viewed as kind of a weakling. And unfortunately, you know, you have the great foreign policy geniuses in the Beltway believing that this means that he's all bluff. And so they all think in a circle. They're all circular. They don't let anyone else in the club that has a different perspective. So they were all reinforcing each other's stereotypes of Russian foreign policy. Well, it turns out that ultimately, despite all this hesitation, he finally realized he was backed into a corner where the existence of Russia itself was threatened. And that's when he decided to act. So I think bringing this together explains why he was so hesitant to finally take military action.
You said that you were not expecting that Russia goes into Ukraine and having this war in Ukraine. Putin himself said that up until the last moment, he didn't know what would be the next step for him and his administration. And this was the last moment decision. It wasn't just before. They didn't plan for this because they were looking after some sort of negotiations with Ukrainians. And he talked about how they were totally in to come out of these negotiations with some sort of solution for the conflict in Ukraine. Look at this and look at what we've seen so far in Ukraine. In your opinion, what was the outcome of this type of behavior on the part of the Western countries, on the part of the United States?
Well, look, at the United States had been pushing Ukraine to fight its proxy war against Russia. I would say since the Orange Revolution, you know, since Yushchenko was placed into power over Yanukovych. And of course, when the next elections occurred, they elected Yanukovych again, because that's who they wanted to rule them. And the U.S. had designs on Ukraine from at least that period on. And I think if you remember back, 2016, 2017, when Senators Lindsey Graham and John McCain were there, well, actually during the Maidan, they were there encouraging the Maidan on. Can you imagine if we were having a revolution here in the United States and there were Russian and Chinese senators standing up at the Lincoln Memorial saying, go for it, guys, take them down, overthrow. I mean, it's just incredible to imagine what happened. But then there's this amazing clip of Lindsey Graham and John McCain there, I think in 16 or 17. They say, this is going to be the year, guys, that you go on the offensive. He was talking to the Ukrainian military. He was goading them and pushing them more toward the war with Russia. This is something they have been pushing for so long. And here you have Zelensky, who runs, who runs on and is elected primarily by Eastern Ukraine, on a peace ticket. I'm not going to be like Poroshenko. I'm not going to tell you you're going to be hiding in your basements. We're going to make peace. And the people from the East said, okay, this is a guy who, you know, he's his Russian, they say, is better than his Ukrainian. I don't speak either, so I don't know. This is a guy who might bring it about. And it turns out, for whatever reason, he brought along just the opposite. And who knows what it was. Maybe it was the very, very strong power of the extremist elements in Ukraine. And I don't know if you've seen Nima, but I've seen several times this amazing confrontation when they were trying to implement the Minsk II agreements, where Zelensky went and met with some of the, I think it was the Azov battalion, but certainly some of the extreme elements. And they basically treated him like he was just a fly. Get out of here. Don't tell us to stop fighting. So it does give you a window into who was really pulling the strings there. And you wonder what's the relationship between something like the Azov battalion and the CIA or those aspects of the American foreign policy that were pushing for an attack on Russia. I would suspect this was probably a lot, just as we're finding out about It My Dan, the connection between the U.S. Secret Services and the extreme violence that accompanied the Maidan protests and ultimately led to the overthrow of the government.
There was a key in his interview that was denazification. When Tucker Carlson asked him, what does it mean? I learned what does it mean in the mind of Putin when he's talking about this. He said something that is written in the constitution of Ukraine.
And it's a big issue there. It's a big issue in the Baltics. And I've been told that the SS there's a commemoration march every year for the SS in Latvia. And I didn't believe it. And I happened to be there one March. And I looked out my window and saw them in SS uniforms marching in Riga. And I was actually shocked that this really happened, because I had no idea. I know there, you know, in the U.S., there are some people that are like that, but they're fringe and they're insane and they have no power and they're laughed at. But there it's a real significant thing. So you're right to understand. And I think Tucker almost thought, and perhaps this is just how he approached it, but almost as if it was this kind of sloganeering, denazification. Yeah, come on. We don't have that problem. But I think it was very poignant when Putin said, look, you had President Zelensky going to the Canadian Parliament, where they honor on the floor of the Parliament, and then the production cut to the actual scene where they're clapping for this 90-some-year-old fellow who fought on the side of the SS. He said, look, it's real. This is not fake. I'm not making it up. I think it was a very poignant moment.
Considering the current stage of war in Ukraine, recently Victoria Nuland was there, and we know that Zelensky dismissed Zelensky. Did this happen because of Victoria Nuland being there and helping to do this, in your opinion?
It certainly seems very very unusual that right when she was there, you saw these things happen afterward. And she did promise Russia will see some surprises. And I've seen others that whose analysis I respect speculating that this might mean a shift from more conventional warfare to more asymmetric warfare, to more insurgency warfare, and apparently that might be the shift. The other issue is that Sirsky, the person who replaced Zelensky, is not well liked among the troops, apparently, unlike Zelensky. And so if this very famous power struggle between Zelensky and Zelensky, there was this fear of a coup. I mean, this is one way it may end, is if there is a coup, a military or otherwise, to overthrow the regime. So I think this may have been a hedge against the possibility of Zelensky building up sort of a personality cult and being able to overthrow Zelensky, because I don't think there's very much risk of Sirsky doing this. And I think that may be part of it. But, you know, there is speculation that the operation will be handed over back over to the experts, sort of quote unquote, in the CIA and in our secret services to plan a different kind of insurgency warfare, which they're pretty good at. If you remember what happened in Syria and other places, at the very least, they know how to blow a lot of things up.
Do you think that this story of Zelensky and Zelensky is done, or are we going to hear much about this, because Zelensky has popularity among the military? It doesn't seem that the United States has the upper hand to control everything there.
No, well, that's the one thing about the neocons. They're never discouraged from getting involved, but everything they touch turns to dirt. You know, it's always been, everything they've done has been a disaster. you know, for the last 35 years. But that doesn't discourage them. The rest of us, we would have a little bit of shame if everything we did in our jobs turned out bad. It doesn't bother them at all. But I mean, if I was illusioning, I would write a huge thank you note to Zelensky. If he's actually going on, maybe it's changed. The last I saw, he's going to go be ambassador in London. I mean, that's fantastic, right? I would much rather be there than to be commanding the troops when the whole thing goes up in flames. This is a country on the verge of a military disaster. We see what's happening in Avdiivka right now, where it looks like there's an encirclement. I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but this would be a major defeat, the biggest defeat they've had since Bakhmut. And if that's the case, it's going to be significant. And you'll see a spiraling effect, I think. But you have that combined with the fact that Zelensky is losing a lot of support in the United States. It's become political in the United States, where Republicans are saying, we don't want to fund, we don't want to send all this money to protect Ukraine's borders when our own borders are a mess here in the U.S. So you're seeing that. You're seeing it be a very big negative for Biden at this point. You're seeing the Europeans left holding the bag because the Americans can't seem to pass this additional $60 billion. And Hungary almost was successful in blocking the, was it 50 billion euros to Ukraine? And I haven't looked through all of the details, but when you look at that 50 billion euros, it's not just a check. They're not just going to back a dump truck up full of money and send it over. There's a lot of different aspects of it and loans and things of this nature. So at the end of the day, they'll probably trickle down a few dollars, who knows? But you know, you're seeing the cascading collapse of the whole situation there. But again, you know, the neocons are in charge in the US and they're not about to back down. When they do, they'll just blame someone else. That's what they always do.
You're talking about neocons. We remember Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell in one of their last meeting with Zelensky, said to Zelensky, you're doing a great job in Ukraine and we are going to send a message to China through the war in Ukraine. In your opinion, what message has been sent to China?
The opposite, exactly the opposite of what he wanted to send to China. I think, you know, McConnell is definitely well past his sell-by date. You know, he's someone who in the past was formidable, not as a great intellectual, but as someone who could get things done in the Senate. Most of those things were bad, but he was very good at getting things done. He's lost that touch, and there's already a bit of a rebellion among backbenchers in the Senate against his leadership in the Republican Party in the Senate. But he's lost a few steps, I think, and I think that's pretty obvious. But, you know, it is sending the opposite message, which is that the U.S. will bite off a lot more than it can chew. And if the U.S. and NATO has sent everything, every single wonder weapon it could possibly send to Ukraine. And you remember starting off, oh, the javelins, that's a game changer. It's going to be all over in a week. And we could go down like 30 or 40 different weapon systems that were going to be game changers. Remember the Leopards, release the Leopards. All of these things have been a failure. You know, what it's shown, and this is what my good friend Doug McGregor said at the beginning, it shows the actual weakness of NATO. You know, they had at least the aura of being a strong military alliance. Well, this has revealed it to be a paper tiger. And China definitely will take note about this. And I think the only reason China has not attacked Taiwan is because it has no intention of attacking Taiwan. They've said it over and over again. We view Taiwan as part of China, and eventually it will become part of China. But it's not something we were going to attack over. It's not the way the Chinese do things. But that's sort of goes over the head of people like McConnell, who are more obsessed with their legacy than on actually, you know, promoting a pro-America foreign policy.
One of the key moments of this interview in which Putin says the biggest enemy of the United States would be China, not Russia, in terms of their population, in terms of their economy. And Tucker Carlson's question was that why the United States decided to fight a war with Russia in Ukraine. If here comes my question, if China is the real enemy, as Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer were talking about, and what Putin was perceiving was the same thing, that he was thinking that if United States want to pick a big enemy for itself, it would be China, not Russia. But what was the, why they started this fight with Russia in Ukraine, in your opinion, in the first place?
Well, I mean, I think there's always a lot of reasons for foreign policy action. There's always a confluence of like antecedents that come together in sort of a perfect storm. But I think if you were to break it down, one of the key components is that the people in charge of U.S. and foreign policy have had a beef against Russia. And some of them are historical reasons. Victoria Nuland has roots in Ukraine. So does Anthony Blinken. A lot of people in the U.S. government have roots in Ukraine. And I guess they figure they want to settle old scores against Russia. The neocons have always hated Russia since the post-Yeltsin period, of course. So I think they have that personal beef with Russia, and that drives a lot the historical view. And who was it I was just hearing? Schumer, Chuck Schumer, has a history in Ukraine. His family history is from Ukraine. So a lot of these people bring the old historical fights from generations ago, and they want to refight them, you know, using the American, strangling the U.S. taxpayer to settle their old beef. So I think that's more of an emotional and historic thing on the part of the U.S. But I think he did make a good point that, you know, if you're looking at who's the biggest threat to you, it's not us. We're Russia. It's not us. It's China. They're up and coming. Their military budget's increasing. Their economic power, even with some of the missteps that they have, is formidable. But the interesting point is when he said that, after he said that, he said, but why do you want to fight with either of us? I forget the exact quote, but he was like, Mr. Tucker, you're hurting yourself. You're hurting your own country. America's hurting itself by even looking for an enemy. And it's really strange because if you think about the self-perception that we have in America, I mean, it's almost like at this point, America is incapable of defining itself as such. It's only defining ourselves as to what we're against, as to what our enemies are. We're against this. We're fighting the war on this. We're against that. And I think it's almost kind of a national psychosis that we have. And it's very, very dangerous.
When it comes to this concept of fighting Russia first and then go after China, do you think that in the mind of neocons, they were thinking that the fight with Russia would be less problematic for them? I don't know if they were thinking that they can defeat Russia in Ukraine, but at least they were thinking to trap Russia in Ukraine, which wasn't the case so far.
Yeah, to give Russia its Vietnam. You know, I think a lot of this goes back to the Brzezinski Doctrine when Russia was in Afghanistan. And, you know, the whole idea was, hey, I got a great idea. Let's arm some jihadists. Let's arm some extremists and set them loose on the world. That'll be a great idea. At least we'll get rid of the commies. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, the world is a chessboard and we can play it any which way we'd like to do. So I think there is this sense that we can do anything. But the problem is that, you know, for the U.S., these wars have been external. We fought in Iraq. We fought in Libya. We've dropped a lot of bombs everywhere around the world. But they have never really reflected an existential threat to the United States. As we know, they've all been based on lies. Well, what the neocons and the people who supported the proxy war with Russia didn't understand and couldn't conceptualize is the fact that when you view it as an existential war, as a war for your survival, when many powerful people in the United States have talked about breaking Russia apart, ending the regime, when you see that on the horizon, you fight in a different kind of way, something that hasn't been experienced in the U.S. before.
With the situation that we're witnessing right now in terms of the partnership between Russia and China, how do you see the future of this partnership? Is it possible for the United States to get in the middle of this partnership or to weaken this partnership to get some sort of advantage? Because if they see China as their peer competitor, Russia should be in the middle.
Well, at this point, no, it's not possible. And that's the most bizarre part about this whole thing. Every U.S. plan was to do that very thing, you know, and it's been the case since Nixon went to China. But the U.S. actions, particularly under the Biden administration, have produced the opposite results. You know, we want to separate them so we can play them off of each other. And what the U.S. foreign policy has done, if anything, has pushed them so tight together that you have China defending Russia's actions. You having massively increased trade. I mean, I'm not Putin, so I don't remember the numbers like he did, but he threw out some figures in the interview yesterday, this dramatic increase in cross-border trade in yuan and rubles, all of these things that didn't happen. Let's not forget the Indians involved as well. So everything that the U.S. foreign policy states as its goals, its actions were counter to those goals. And you have to wonder, are they really that incompetent? You know, what's going on here? It's a question that I mean, to me, it seems pretty easy. But then again, you know, I don't have any power. So, but who knows?
The other thing that he said that I found it fascinating, he said before this war started, their trade, 50% of their trade were in dollar. And right now that percentage reduced to 13%. That's huge. Do you think that with the situation they're in right now, with the situation that they're having right now, is that possible to get to the point that they were before? Is it possible to get to the point that 50% of their trades were in dollar? Oh, it's gone.
I think it's gone. I think the world has changed. And ironically, it's the U.S. shooting itself in the head and in the foot. We had a great deal. You know, the U.S. was buying inexpensive things from China, and China was taking the dollars that we were printing out of thin air. It was a win-win for the U.S. And the U.S. decided to shoot itself in the foot. But, you know, it's also the overuse. I mean, when you use a dollar as a weapon, it can explode in your face. And that's what happened. Every country that did something we didn't like, we sanctioned them. We said, you can't use dollars. You can't have dollars. You can't do trade. And, you know, with Iran as well, Iran is now a major player in the Middle East. And most of that, or a lot of that, is because of the U.S. policy of isolating China. They had to find partners elsewhere. And they did. And they've been very profitable for Iran. In the region, Iran has become a major powerhouse in the region, and it's because of U.S. foreign policy. So everything is having the opposite effect. Will the U.S. reindustrialize? The only thing the U.S. produces, it seems, is military equipment, and that's not going to, you know, get us a better car or provide consumer goods for America. These are things that you produce, and then they blow up. So there's no reindustrialization. We don't have any industrial base, and I think that's the other thing about this war that has changed a lot of the fantasies that we have about ourselves, the realization that we're going to promise, and the Europeans have done it too, we're going to promise to deliver this many missiles to Ukraine. And then they say, we can't produce these missiles. Raytheon says, we can't make these fast enough. It's impossible. We do not have the industrial capacity even to do this. So we've offshored everything, and we don't have the ability to do it. And we don't produce very much. I guess we can export TikTok videos or something, but that seems to be about the only thing the U.S. produces anymore.
How did you find the Biden administration's policy in Israel, in Gaza?
Well, it was from the very beginning the worst possible policy, because but Biden had a big plan. You know, when the Israelis launched their counterattack after the 7th of October, which was he was going to go over there and meet with Netanyahu and, you know, give him a pat on the back and say, we're with you. And then he was going to meet with the other Arab leaders in a summit. Well, in between the two, lo and behold, the Israelis bombed a hospital. They said they didn't bomb it. It turns out they bombed every other hospital, so they probably did bomb it. The other Arab leaders said, we're not going to meet with you. You know, you're supporting this. So essentially, it ended up in Joe Biden giving Netanyahu a green light. And that's continued, I would say, until yesterday. Believe it or not, until yesterday, it was 30,000 civilians killed. And it was only yesterday when the 8th or whatever, when Joe Biden said, I think they're a little over the top in their reaction to October 7th. As Netanyahu is ready to go into Rafah and to bomb them, which is where a million people have escaped from the other bombs. So the Biden administration, not only in terms of humanitarian issues and those of us who care about human beings, it's been a disaster. But politically for him, it's been a disaster. And he sees it, and it's there in the polls. It's very, very obvious in the polls. And because of this specific issue, the polls are going against him.
Do you see that we finally get to the point of a permanent ceasefire in Gaza? Is it possible, in your opinion?
Not in the current form, because Netanyahu has already said it's out of the question until we meet our objectives. And he just said today, you know, there are 12 divisions of Hamas still in Rafah, and we can't do anything until we've exterminated all of them. Well, they're not doing that well against Hamas, from what we read. They seem to be very good at bombing innocent civilians, but not at taking out Hamas. Israel is taking a lot of casualties, many more than they're counting. You've probably seen some of the videos as well in the Israeli military. And these are conscripts. These are kids. They're not professional soldiers, by and large. And the evidence of that is if you look at their age and their rank in the military, there's a real disparity. If you're a 25-year-old colonel, you don't have a lot of military experience. You're not a command officer. So these guys are getting shot. There's a lot of casualties. But Netanyahu is fighting for his political life, and he's fighting for his freedom. And he's got, you know, just before October 7th happened, every day there were protests outside of his office. They wanted him out. He's got corruption scandal after corruption scandal. You know, the Israelis are furious with him, and he's walking a fine line now. So he's fighting for his own political life right now. So he's not about to back down. And plus, a lot of the opposition, a lot of the pressure on him is from the more extremist elements. And I never thought, I mean, I followed Netanyahu since 96 at least. I never thought that I would see him being a relative moderate, and that's what he's turned into in this fight in Gaza right now.
Considering the voters of the Democratic Party, especially the progressive part of this party, they're not so happy with the situation, with the way that the Biden administration was handling the conflict in Gaza. One of the very important points that they're making is this: why the Biden administration is not capable of controlling the Netanyahu administration, because without the support coming from the U.S., they're not capable of doing anything.
Well, the Biden administration is between a rock and a hard place, because you have the donor class, which remains very strongly pro-Israel, whether it's Democratic Party or Republican Party, very, very strongly pro-Israel. These are the people who contribute a very, very large amount of money. And there's the contradiction between that and between the voters. And the Democratic voters are increasingly, poll after poll, showing opposed to the Biden administration's policies in Gaza. And I think it's something as high, I think there was a poll in December, as high as 73% of Democratic voters were opposed to Biden's policy toward Gaza. And I think in that same poll, if I remember right, 49% of Republicans were in favor of a ceasefire in Gaza, which is unheard of. Usually the Republicans are more hawkish. There was a recent poll out this week, I think, an AP YouGov poll that showed 63% of Democrats believe that Israel has gone too far in its actions in Gaza. 63%. And among Democratic voters under 45, that's 7 in 10. 7 in 10 Democratic voters under the age of 45 are completely opposed to the policy of Biden. They believe that Israel has gone too far. And I think by inference, you would say, as you started your question out by saying, if you believe that, then you would believe that Biden has leverage to pull back. And to pull back would simply mean for Biden to say, no more weapons. We've had enough. You've gone too far. But instead, and I track military planes sometimes over the region, you see supply plane over supply plane over supply plane back and forth delivering the supplies. So you're having this kind of, and you're even having Biden at rallies being heckled by his own Democratic voters. They're not Republicans out there, calling him a war criminal. And that's, it's a disaster for him in terms of the election coming up.
When it comes to this conflict in the Red Sea, it got to a point that the United States was asking China to help them with Houthis, and China gonna talk to Iran. Do you understand what's going on?
It's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. You know, you have Biden and Blinken calling Xi Jinping a dictator and a bad guy, and then you say, hey, by the way, can you get us out of this pickle that we got ourselves in? And talk about a lack of self-understanding. You know, the reason why the Houthis, and they were very clear about this, the reason why the Houthis were interfering with shipping was that ships going to Israeli ports were going to be interdicted by the Houthis. They have the power to do it by the virtue of their geographic location and the peculiar geographic attributes of Yemen in the Red Sea. They have the capability of doing it. They said they were going to do it. And they did it. It's not reported in the U.S., but the reason was the Israeli slaughter of Gaza that has been backed up by the U.S. Now, they weren't attacking U.S. or U.K. ships until the U.S. and U.K. started bombing them. And they said, okay, do you want to play too? Then we're going to start attacking your ships as well. And there was an amazing event, I think it was last week maybe, or a week and a half ago, where there was, and I don't remember which ship it was, a U.S. Military escort of two Maersk container ships, apparently bringing weapons to Israel, and they came under fire, And they all turned around and ran tail and run. I mean, this is something that students of military history are going to study in the future when you start thinking about asymmetric warfare and other things like swarming. And I think it was Alistair Crook, who I think is a brilliant mind. I think it was he that wrote an article recently on swarming and how these kind of swarming techniques are enormously successful. These sort of almost pseudo non-governmental actors, the Houthis are in a sense. And they've been able to stop, you know, the world's arguably, at least what we thought until Ukraine came, the world's strongest military superpower has been defeated by these people who, you know, the U.S. didn't even take seriously.
The other important thing that has happened in this conflict in the Red Sea was the participation of the Saudi Arabia and UAE, that they were not willing to be part of this operation. In your opinion, how important was that deal that China cut between Iran and Saudi Arabia in this situation that we are witnessing right now in the Red Sea?
I think it was absolutely critical. And it probably, once again, wouldn't have taken place if it wasn't for the events in Ukraine, pushing these countries together and really doing two things, pushing the U.S. out of the Middle East, and ironically, because U.S. foreign policy has always been to strongly support Israel, to put Israel in a situation where it's surrounded by people who don't want to have anything to do with it. And this is before October the 7th. You know, this happened, as you say, when the Chinese were helping facilitate this peace agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I mean, peace breaking out in the region undermined a central Israeli policy, which is to keep these guys hating each other and fighting against each other, divide and conquer. And now what you've done, you've not united all these countries against Israel. So good job, Washington, D.C. But it's remarkable to see. And you had this unbelievable spectacle, I think it was last week, where Blinken made, I don't know how many trips, I think this is his fifth. He's there now, so something bad's going to happen. But I think it was his previous trip where he gave a press conference and said, yeah, the Saudis are really interested in reopening discussions with Israel about recognition. And the Saudis released this blistering press release saying, what are you talking about? We have absolutely no intention of doing this until there's a viable Palestinian state put up. You know, what are you talking about? He just ended up looking like a fool. It's almost as if they believe that their wishes and fantasies could just by the power of their will be manifested into reality.
In terms of the future of Israel, we have to consider that at the end of the day, we have to have some sort of peace in that region, because Israel is surrounded by these Arab nations. And we have to find a solution, a permanent solution for this conflict in Gaza. But it doesn't seem the Netanyahu administration is looking for such a solution for this conflict.
Well, from what I can see, I almost wonder if there's not some sort of a mass psychosis in Israel. You know, it's similar to the mass psychosis we had during the COVID era, where people were doing irrational and self-harming things because they were told to do so by the experts. And we're seeing an absolute depopulation of Israel. I think one day last week, 30,000 people left. You've had the northern part of Israel is now abandoned. A million people, I guess it was something like this, who've been displaced from that part. They're not about to go back until this is solved. You're seeing a real possibility of the destruction of the end of Israel. And if Israel didn't have nuclear weapons and wasn't willing to use them to stay on that piece of land, it may have already taken place. It's the strangest thing I've ever seen. It doesn't bode well for the future because they've enraged the Arab world, and it's a neighborhood they have to live in. And this is where I blame U.S. foreign policy the most, in a way, because we have enabled this kind of relationship. You know, in economics, it's it's a moral hazard where you facilitate someone making a bad choice with their money because they believe that you're backing them up. And we've created a huge moral hazard for the Israelis to bite off more than they can chew because they always have this implied belief that the U.S. will back them up. I think that's one of the reasons they're being so aggressive toward Hezbollah, because they believe at the end of the day, U.S. will send troops to back them up. Well, if the U.S. hadn't given them this carte blanche, if the U.S. hadn't facilitated their aggressive behavior, they would have had to find some different mode of operation in the region. They would have had to make peace on their own, and they would have been far better off. So here's the biggest irony of all. The U.S. proclaims itself the greatest protector, the greatest friend, the greatest ally of Israel. But U.S. policy of backing Israel without question has put Israel in a position where its future, for the first time since 1948, its literal future is in huge doubt. How's that for a friend? That's not the kind of friend I'd like to have.